And they all lived there because of the same reason, ultimately, and that is because it was the winter palace for the kings of Persia. So a particular dynasty or dynasty, it was for a period of, I don't know, for about 300 or 400 years, they would often go retreat there for the winter time. So that gives us some background as to why Nehemiah is there, and we get some idea of what time of year it was. It was probably either late autumn, winter, or early spring. Although, to be honest,
I don't know what time of day it was, and I don't know what month or whatever, because it's not relevant. However, the next part is kind of relevant, because what we need to do is understand, and we need to put certain things into context. So if we go on to, we go from the where to the when, and then let's have a deal with a little bit of history. Now, the fall, it depends where you look. I've used Usher, so if anyone knows Usher, then I've got Usher at home, and that's a wonderful book. It puts biblical history, a lot of ancient history on top of each other, and gives you some kind of sort of historic context for everything. He goes for 599, some of the modern Bibles, they go for 586. It doesn't matter, it was a long time ago, roughly 600 AD. The first remnant returns around about 538, as Zedekiah, and he effectively then rebuilds the temple. At some point between there and 485, Esther marries the king, King Xerxes, and saves the people from annihilation. And that's the children, that's this lesson that the children are going to learn, how God uses this young girl to effectively turn the hearts of a conquering king. And this guy is an incredibly powerful and scary individual, which I don't think we even begin to understand. We read our Bible and we see these people's names, and sometimes we just view them completely wrongly. This guy is incredible. There was a battle that had been going on for quite some time. So in 485, he subdued Egypt. Now Egypt, and if you know anything about ancient history, Egypt is an incredible kingdom, a very powerful kingdom, a very wealthy kingdom. He subdued that. For the next 4 years, he then effectively then comes back to Susa, and he effectively builds an army, because his next conquest is effectively moving into Europe, and particularly into Greece, and then from that area moving on. So then there's a period of 2 years of full-scale war. Now, I'll give you some context about this. You think, well, okay, biblical history, you might get some pictures of a couple of thousand people, whatever. His navy was 1,000 ships in size. 207 of them in ancient manuscripts are recorded as being swift, so they were incredibly fast military vessels that could get from A to B. I don't know how they were designed, but they were set aside from the rest. In his navy, he had 517,610 people. 500,000 people in his navy. We're not talking about some small, insignificant king here. We're talking about the most impressive individual, humanly speaking, on earth at that time. He had an army which he assembled of 1,700,000 foot soldiers. And he had a cavalry of 80,000. This is a mighty force. And not only did he didn't just sit back, he went into battle. He is one scary individual, one battle-focused, bloodthirsty, conquering, strong, powerful, scary individual. And then in 474, you've got to be careful who you hire to work for you, I'll tell you. His captain of the guard, a chap called Artabanus, plots and kills him. And then he cleverly blames it upon his eldest son, which was Darius. So Artaxerxes, who was the king at Nehemiah's time, hears about this and he kills his older brother, because he thinks that his older brother's killed his father to become king early. So this is the family that he's been brought into. This is the individual that he is. Because he's quite a young individual at the time, because he's still quite young, Artabanus at that time effectively rules for about 7 months in the young king's stead. So he effectively takes control for a period of time. After probably about a year, Artabanus gets a bit fed up of being the puppet king, and he decides that he wants to kill Artaxerxes. So he plans to kill the young king. But he then gets found out.
and the young king chases him down in battle, strips him naked, and drives a sword through. So this is who we're talking about. This is a young guy who's now killed his father's and his brother's killer.
6 years later, Ezra, under the instructions from Artaxerxes, and in with full okay, which we will read in the book of Ezra, returns to Jerusalem. And his main mission there is to effectively resettle the Jewish state and to reform the religion in Jerusalem and in that nation. So as opposed to being out, he's now bringing it back home. So the temple had been built years before, and now Ezra's then going back. And then we skip forward 13 years, and we get the 20th reign of Artaxerxes, and that's when this book starts.
The other bit of context which I'll give you is that Ezra and Nehemiah in early manuscripts were effectively one book. So effectively they were Ezra moved into Nehemiah. And if you look at the book, you will see that Ezra appears part of the way through the book of Ezra. He then disappears and then he reappears in chapter 8 of Nehemiah as the priest. So Nehemiah is effectively the governor and you've got Ezra who's the priest. So hopefully I haven't blown your mind too much with all the dates and the information. The important thing is to try and put some context as to why Nehemiah was feeling as he was and who he was dealing with. This wasn't some soft and gentle king. This was an incredibly powerful man, but used by God, was helping the Jewish nation and his and God's people to effectively return from exile because they were turning back to him.
So who? So we've dealt with the where, the when, now the who. So who's Nehemiah? Nehemiah is the cupbearer to the king. Now, if you say, well, who's the cupbearer to the king, do you get some view of some kind of glorified butler? Because if you do, then your idea of what a cupbearer is just completely wrong. It isn't. That isn't the role at all. It's a high-ranking role. Not only is it a high-ranking role, he puts his life on the line every single mealtime for that king, quite literally. Because he will sip the wine first or the drink first just to make sure that it's not poisoned. That's a role you just don't aspire to, particularly if the king's not popular. So that would be my first thing. But it's well paid. The job comes with a high degree of risk, but it was also a well paid job. And not only that, it gave him an incredible closeness to the king. They had a very good and close relationship with the king because it's a high position of trust. You don't have a position where you put a lot of trust in someone who you just don't care for, you just don't know, and vice versa. So there was an incredible strong relationship between Nehemiah and King Artaxerxes. So we've dealt with the who as well. Now let's look at the first chapter. If we can move on to the first point.
We can see in the first few verses that some people come back and give him some troubling news. So what's his response to that troubling news? He's heard about the holy place, God's chosen country, if you like, and he's heard. So what is his response? Is it anger? Is it frustration? It isn't. His first response that you will find there was, he weeps. If I look back at some of the troubles that we've had as a church over the last year, some of our initial reaction has not been weeping. For some of us, it has been anger. Weeping is where we need to go to. And weeping is where, I'm not saying we need to go there now. Weeping is where we needed to go to. But then moving on from that, it was then, bugger. Mourning, fasting and prayer, an appropriate way, a way which is laid down in the Bible many, many times. It is appropriate when you'll be given bad news to deal with it in the right way, not for anger, not let the devil get in, but then bring ourselves down. So that's what it is. He mourns, he fasts, and he commits everything to God in prayer. Because the one person, the only person ultimately, can help anybody is God. And Nehemiah turned to God. And that is the thing that really strikes me, and I hope it will strike you, in chapter 1 and chapter 2.
that there are effectively three different aspects of prayer mentioned here. You've got the one which is mentioned here, which doesn't talk about the prayer itself, but just says that he devoted that period of time and his life into prayer because of that issue. We then move on to the next part, where we deal with the petition prayer. And this prayer is an incredible prayer, just looking at the way in which it is laid out. First of all, in all good prayers, we acknowledge who God is. And that's what he does, right at the very, very beginning. O Lord God of heaven, the great and awesome God, who keeps his covenant of love with those who love him and obey his commands. So he reminds God, or lets God know, number one, who he is, but reminds God who he is. So there's an acknowledgement of who he is, whose presence he is coming into. And then he requests that his pleading is heard. Let your ear be attentive and your eyes open to hear the prayer your servant is praying before you day and night for your servants, the people of Israel. It's a continual prayer. This is not some prayer that is thrown out like a hand grenade and then he's run. He is constantly praying. The fact that we've got this one recorded is for our edification. This isn't to show off Nehemiah's praying skills. This is to lay out a very well concise one for us to be able to learn from. But it's effectively summarizing all of that prayer activity that he is going through up until a very important event, because this is a preparation prayer. So effectively, he's acknowledged who God is, he's pleaded to be heard, and then he confesses his sin. He confesses his sin. He doesn't just point the finger and say, look, the reason why it's all happened is because they have done this and they do that, and because he's this and she's that. He has acknowledged that prayer. He has acknowledged that sin, and he's looked at the sin of his people, looked at the sin of his family, and looked at the sin of himself, and has asked for forgiveness. And then once he's gone through that, he then moves on to the next aspect, which is reminding God of his previous promises. Verse 8, remember the instruction you gave your servant Moses, saying, if you are unfaithful, I will scatter you among the nations. But if you return to me and obey my commands, then even if your exiled people are at the farthest horizon, I will gather them from there and bring them to the place I have chosen as a dwelling for my name. You know, the Lord has made many promises for us as well. And they're not just there for us to read, but they're there for us to grab hold of, to cling to, and in our prayers to remind God of. So when we are at our depths, when we are at those moments when we need God's help, and even when we're not, to pick hold of these gospel truths and to present them before God, to remind God of his promises, and remind God of his covenants which he's made with us. And we cling on to that, because then that then leads on to the last part of his prayer. And it's the last verse. He's bold. He's bold because he's laid the foundation to be bold. And that is this last bit. Give your servant success today by granting him favour in the presence of this man. And that really concludes, and then he kind of throws that last thing in the end there. I was a cupbearer to the king. So he's putting himself into that position. He's explaining to you what the news was. He's laid out the prayer. And then he's talked about the going before this man. And we've now done the context. We now understand who this man is he's going before. A terrifying, powerful ruler. And so we then move into chapter 2. Shall we read? Shall we return to our Bibles and we'll read it? Because I think it is really important. I could talk about it, but I think it's really important that we read it. So let's go. Nehemiah chapter 2 and verse 1. In the month of Nisan, in the 20th year of King Artaxerxes, when wine was brought for him, I took the wine and gave it to the king. I had not been sad in his presence before. So the king asked me, why does your face look so sad when you are not ill? This can be nothing but sadness of the heart. I was very much afraid. But I said to the king, may the king live forever. Why should my face not look sad when the city where my fathers are buried lies in ruins and its gates have been destroyed by fire? The king said to me, what is it
you want. Then I prayed to the God of heaven, and I answered the king. If it pleases the king, and if your servant has found favour in his sight, let him send me to the city of Judah where my fathers are buried, so that I can rebuild it. Then the king, with the queen sitting beside him, asked me, how long will your journey take, and when will you get back? It pleased the king to send me, so I set a time. I also said to him, if it pleases the king, may I have letters to the governors of the Trans-Euphrates, so that they will provide me safe conduct till I arrive in Judah? And may I have a letter to Asaph, keeper of the king's forest, so that he will give me timber to make beams for the gates of the citadel, by the temple, and for the city wall, and for the residence I will occupy? And because the gracious hand of my God was upon me, the king granted my requests. Okay, we'll stop there for a second. To go in front of the king with a sad face, do you think that that's any big shakes? You know, if we had a bad day or a bad, and then we go to work and we've got a bit of a grumpy face on or a bit of a sad face on, is anything like that happening to us other than somebody avoids us for a day? The reality is that a sad or a grumpy face is not going to be the end of the world for that day. However, he was scared for good cause. He was going into the presence of the king. Don't forget, if you pass your mind back to his father, when Queen Vashti basically turns around and says, I'm not going to bother coming into your presence. She didn't want to go into that presence. And maybe she had good cause not to want to go into his presence. Here, and his reaction afterwards. These people were a vicious people that could have had his job finished, he could have been killed. So the idea that he goes with a sad face is a serious issue, and one which gave him grave concerns. But at the same time, how could he hide away his sadness within his heart because of the news that he had heard? And then the royal request, because he's seen the face, and because Artaxerxes is the kind of character that he is, although he did kill somebody at that age, and although he is a strong ruler, at the same time we've already seen that Ezra has been released to go back to Jerusalem to set up the nation, but also most importantly to set up the priesthood in Jerusalem. We've got a king who has got a small g godly heart. So he is then presented with this request. Boy, what does he respond to now? So he offers up, and you see it here in verse 4, then I prayed to the God of heaven. This was not a 5-minute prayer. This wasn't a, can I step outside for an hour and have a prayer meeting prayer. This was a very quick prayer. But based upon the foundation of days and days of mourning and fasting and praying and repeatedly petitioning before God. So if we think that we can go through our lives with these hand grenade prayers where we effectively reach an issue, we throw a prayer in, and then we move on and we expect to get a response, that's not what we see here. This is a prayer that is sitting on top of a life of prayer and who has focused his particular moment on a particular issue that he has now come to a head and he's now been given an opportunity. But he doesn't boldly move on with that opportunity until he commits that moment to his God in prayer. So he's reinforcing that moment, that request, that opportunity with prayer. I love what then comes next. This is not some guy who just wants to go back and see what's happened and try and put things right by gathering a few people to do some building projects. He then has incredible plans. Not only does he ask for a period of time to go away and to do all this, he then says he wants some letters to go to the governors, so he's very bold in that one. But not only that, he also wants the timber and everything else. So he's asking the king to give a lot to him for one simple request. If we then move on, so go back to your Bibles in chapter 2, and we move towards the back part of the verse 16. There is a moment there where he goes to Jerusalem and he slips out and has a look at the wall. And there are certain places where he finds it very difficult to look at. So he does a survey while everybody else is asleep. He then comes back. Verse 16 captures it. The officials did not know where I had gone or what I was doing. because as yet I had said nothing to the Jews or the priests or the nobles or the officials or any others who would be doing the work. Let's stop there for a second. An interesting point is here that the workers who were going to be doing this work didn't know that they were going to be doing this work. He knew, God knew that they were going to be doing this work. Nehemiah had confidence that God would provide the workers, but these people sitting here didn't know. Now today, it's a bit like the rebuilding of the wall here. We have an opportunity to rebuild this church, to reach out to this community, to take God's word out and to be a shining light in this community on behalf of God. There are people sitting here today that do not know that they have jobs in that new work, but God wants you to be involved in his work. I do not know. God knows, and to God's glory, he will use you mightily to take out his word into this community, to reach this community, and to make a difference in this community. Not because we want a good and nice community, but because we want a community that knows God, that loves God, and has had their lives changed by God because of us and because of God using us. What a tremendous opportunity that is. The last part, then. He then gets some people around him who really don't like what he's doing. You know, you always get people, whenever you are doing something for God, the devil isn't going to like it, and the devil will send even godly people sometimes to give you a hard time over it. Even though they think they're doing the right thing, they're not necessarily doing the right thing. And his response is telling. I answered them by saying, the God of heaven who will give us success. We, his servants, will start rebuilding. But as for you, you have no share in Jerusalem or any claim or historic right to it. But I don't want to go on that second part. What I really want to do is concentrate on that first one. The Lord of heaven will give us success. We, his servants, will start rebuilding. We, his servants, will start rebuilding. He was absolutely focused on the fact that he will, with God's authority, because he knows it, because he's committed it to God, he will start the rebuild. 52 days later, they had rebuilt it, and the nations around trembled because they had rebuilt it, and because God, through those men and women, had made a statement to the world that he had forgiven his people, that his people had returned, and that he was redeeming, loving, and just God. So let's leave that one with you, that last verse. We, his servants, will start rebuilding. Where is it that you've got to in your Christian life? Where is it that God is dealing with you at the moment? What aspects of your life do you need to deal with to be able to be used by him to build his kingdom? And for us to focus upon that, so that we can then be ready to do his bidding and his will. That's the one message which I want you to take home with you today. We close with our last hymn.
And don't forget, after the last hymn, there is going to be cake.